Hello, and welcome once again to the Lime Leaf Podcast. My name is John. I'm joined by Blaine. Hello, Blaine.
Hey, how's it going?
And Mubs. Hello, Mubs.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Pretty good. We're back after a bit of a hiatus. This is a show about how to save the tech industry through open source, open standards, and worker ownership. We are Lime Leaf, a member-owned co-op specializing in Rust and Go software product development, and we are also doing some work with AT Protocol. Check our site for more information, limeleaf.coop. So on today's episode, we're going to talk about the state of computer science higher education. But first, we have some plugs. Apply.coop, our online job board for values-driven workplaces, has launched. If you're an employer looking for good people or a person who wants to do meaningful work that doesn't suck, visit apply.coop. The site is free for job seekers, and yes, we mean free. No ads, no creepy trackers, no spam. Employers pay only $30 for a one-month job listing, but posting jobs is free for podcast listeners. Just use the promo code SOLIDARITY during checkout. Once again, apply.coop, apply.coop. We also run Blue Sky Directory, a human-curated collection of all things related to Blue Sky's social media platform. Browse millions of Blue Sky profiles, starter packs, feeds, and tools that help you get the most out of your Blue Sky experience at blueskydirectory.com. We also publish a weekly Blue Sky newsletter, and we do ads. These are simple, non-intrusive, privacy-respecting text ads that reach tens of thousands of passionate Blue Sky users every day. Visit blueskydirectory.com/advertise to learn more. All right, we'll take a break. Okay, we're back. All right, I just went through it. I'll edit yours out later because we were getting some background from you. All right, so starting back up, 3, 2, 1. First little levity, we wanted to just, you know, there's been some, I guess you call it pushback against AI and automation recently. I just wanted to share some interesting and amusing new words, which are actually, I guess, you know, more slurs that we've seen appearing recently in the tech lexicon. First is clanker, also wireback and cogsucker. These were new to me. I was on vacation and wasn't online much, but all of a sudden everyone's talking about clankers. This originated, I guess, in a Star Wars video game. And now apparently is the internet's favorite epithet for any kind of technology looking to replace humans. Were you familiar with this before I sent it around the other day? I had never heard of this.
Not those ones. Oh, those are good though.
Well, I guess there's also all these TikTok videos of people harassing robots. And a senator from Arizona, Ruben Gallego, used the term last week to tout a new piece of legislation. He said, "Sick of yelling representative into the phone 10 times just to talk to a human being? My new bill makes sure you don't have to talk to a clanker if you don't want to." that one was pretty funny, but the one I liked more was slop squatting. This is a type of cyber squatting. It's the practice of registering a non-existent software package name that large language models may hallucinate in their output, whereby someone unknowingly may copy, paste, and install the software package without realizing it is fake. Attempting to install a non-existent package should result in an error, but some have exploited this for their gain in the form of typo squatting. In April 2025, the term was coined by Python Software Foundation developer in residence and security researcher Seth Larson, popularized by Andrew Nesbitt on Mastodon. I don't know who either of those people are. So, yeah, this is just, you know, these things are hallucinating. I don't know. GPT-5 just launched as we're recording this. They claim there's less hallucination in there. Have you guys run up against anything like this of people reporting packages that like just don't exist, but AI bots think they do, or LLMs think they do, or whatever?
No, I don't think I play in those languages where those people hang out.
Yeah, right. I think that's
to be quite frank.
Yeah, like Hugging Face, we don't ever. I don't think we're ever going to need the Hugging Face command line interface, which apparently is one of them. Hugging Face -CLI. While this name is identical to the command used for the command line version of Hugging Face Hub, it is not the name of the package, which is Hugging Face underscore hub bracket CLI bracket. So yeah, I think these kind of things are just going to happen more and more as vibe coding takes off. I think with people just like, okay, it built something and it runs and put it in GitHub, and yeah, who knows? We're about to see a wild west of all kinds of this stuff happening. But you guys write a lot more code than I do. Is AI really saving you much time if you have to then everything it writes go back with a fine-tooth comb? It's like the code review from hell, where you have to, like, if you work with somebody and you trust their skills mostly, your code review is just sort of not cursory, but like if your code review of AI generated stuff is line by line, every single dependency, checking every single thing, like, are you really being more productive? I don't know. You guys know better than me. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, for me personally, how I'm using AI is mostly to replace things like Stack Overflow, right? Like, if I run into a specific bug, if I run into a specific issue that I don't know the answer to, in the past I would have gone to Stack Overflow and read through 10 or 20 different posts to find the answer of what I wanted. And instead, I'm going to AI and saying, look, here's my problem. You do that in terms of figuring out what the most likely answer is. And even with Stack Overflow, I never trusted what I read. Like, I had to read it to see if I could understand the solution, see if it was appropriate for what I was working on. And I do the same here. Like, AI will tell me what the answer is, and I read it and I say, well, okay, that seems to make sense in terms of it solving the issue. So it saved me a little bit of time, sure, but I'm not, generally I'm not wasting days and weeks on those things anyway, right? Like, it's if it saves me 15 minutes or it saves me an hour, then awesome. But it's not going to be this massive, like, I'm not going to suddenly become a 100x engineer because I'm now using AI. The other thing that I found that some people saying that, it's making me so productive. In most cases, all it's doing is it's like generating scaffolding for you in terms of, like, here's the class, here's the package that I want to write. Can you just write me all of the files that I need to make that package? And I'm like, yeah, we had CLIs for this already. Like, if you want to, if you want to clone a repo from GitHub, it has all of the files that you need to kind of do that thing. So again, if you're starting out, you don't know that these things exist, and you're just going to talk to AI, it's going to do these things for you, then yeah, maybe it is going to save you some time because you don't know what you don't know, and so AI is kind of answering that kind of stuff for you. But in general, as a medium senior level engineer, it is a performance improvement. Like, it is saving me a little bit of time, but the huge improvements that everybody's touting, no, I'm not. I'm not seeing any of that stuff.
Yeah, same for me. Like, I think we've just been doing this so long. Like, I know what I have to do. Even some during like the boilerplate stuff, I have past code bases that I can pull from that I know has already worked and tested and everything. So I just don't rely on it. I don't have anything hooked up to my editor doing anything. I have no models, no nothing. I'm not paying for any AI at all. Like on the rare occasions, just to try it out, it's mostly like, oh, I don't want to read the documentation for the auto-generated code for the AWS Go SDK because it's terrible. And so I would ask, like, okay, I need to integrate this as the Go SDK for our CloudWatch. Like, give me the basic config to get me going. And it gives me the five lines that I need because I don't want to go read through it. And then I just go from there. And then I just leave it alone. The only other time I really found it useful was generating SQL seed data. Like, here's my create table SQL statement of my 20 fields. Maybe it's a contact or a user table. Like, okay, can you just generate me 100 insert statements with randomized data? Like, just that's it. And then I go about my day. But yeah, like Mub said, like, we've had mock data generation tools, we've had CLIs. So, I mean, Rails was probably one of the first ones that came up with this. Like, Rails knew, give me an entire repo
Yeah, I remember
of
that.
models, controllers, and views, and a database. And like, this stuff has existed for over 20 years or something.
And I find I find JavaScript is the exception to that, right? Like all of these like Next frameworks and stuff. That's why like the boilerplates sold so well in the JavaScript world, because most JavaScript projects you had to start from scratch. You had to compose, you know, you had to do sort of npm init, and then you kind of did everything. That's why when people like launched like the boilerplates for like JavaScript and TypeScript projects, they sold so well because they did that for you. But you don't need an AI for that. Like you can literally just go on to any, you can find hundreds of these things on GitHub. But you still have to like read over them to understand what they're doing in terms of how, you know, how are they interfacing with the databases? How are they doing all of the, how they're doing logging? And you still have to understand what's happening under the hood. So you can get started really fast just by leveraging, saying AI, go basically search GitHub and find me a starter pack and kind of launch my project for me. But then you're trusting this AI without really understanding how it all works and what the utilities are and answer all of that stuff as well.
Yeah, and I'm not, and I don't want to like segregate the people that are probably doing this, but just anecdotally in my experience, like the people that this tends to, like people tend to do this the most are the ones that are building things in JavaScript and Python.
Yeah.
Like once you get into C and C++ and Go and Rust and all like different classes of languages, like those people are few and far between. It's traditional, maybe you guys have seen different, but that's what I've just generally seen. I don't know if it's my bubble that I'm in. I haven't really spent time to like answer that question, but yeah, most of the vibe coding is like, yeah, wrote this whole thing in JavaScript, it's got no tests and it worked great, but now it kind of doesn't work and I don't know if I want it. Like, well, okay.
It seems
Yeah,
to me, it's. I mean, again, this is what you know, I'm seeing on social media and stuff. I'm sure there's people doing this who aren't talking about it and we don't know how they're using it and stuff, but from what you hear about publicly people talking about it, it's the people that were doing no-code tools to try and WYSIWYG their application together or using like some kind of code generation tools to kind of automate as much of their build as they could, and they just instead of having to point and click and do these things, now they just use the chat interface to talk to OpenAI or Claude or whoever and have it spit out a bunch of code that they may or may not understand, but it runs and it looks like what they wanted it to look like. And that's fantastic. Like if you can, if you're comfortable pushing out code like that, you know, more power to you. But you know that, but then, you know, the minute that you want to like make a change, make an enhancement that AI can't do for some reason, then that's where you run into issues, and that's where you end up having to like hire somebody, or you end up having to read through the code yourself and try to understand what's happening. And I think we're going to talk about like PS and kind of learning in a few minutes, but I mean, that's where I think this stuff is actually really helpful. Like, you know, if you actually want to improve your skills, learn, you know, how to write software, like having access to this kind of stuff, I think is actually really helpful, because I always found it's easier to learn something by making changes to code that existed already, rather than having a blank page and saying, oh, I need to write some software that will do X, Y, and Z. If there was software that wrote X and Y already, and I need to add Z, it's much easier to like learn and understand like, okay, where do I do the things that I need to do? And so having AI to be act as like a teacher and a way to learn how to do software engineering, I think is going to be awesome, but it doesn't feel like that's what people are using it for right now. They're just like saying, I need to build this software. I'm going to have AI do it and I'm just going to launch it. Right. That to me is kind of a scary world.
Right. And that's the pressure that they're getting from the places that they're working at, because the thing needs to be built yesterday to like satisfy a sprint point or a funding round or something, and that needs to get built and done.
Right. So the places where they work don't want to pay them. They want as few of them as possible. They want to replace
all of them. Which, you know, we're you know coming full circle of you know, the company of one. Like we don't the startup founder doesn't want to pay engineers. They want to go from zero to idea to funding to making money,
which is a piece of that I don't hear a lot of people talking about. I mean, there's people like Ed Zitron and like the really sort of AI is a big scam people is like, there's all this efficiency that people are claiming, like, oh, you know, I can use Copilot or I can use Windsurf or whatever, and it cuts my makes me so productive, and I only pay $20 a month for it. It's, well, that's because the entire thing is being subsidized by billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in venture capital, government money. The Defense Department is now starting to pay these guys. So once all that's subsidy, I mean, these guys have to make a profit at some point, whether it's now or 5 years from now. So if you start using so much of this stuff and get so reliant on it, I think this, I've read something that Anthropic has already kind of done this. All of a sudden you get a 50x price increase in what you are relying, all this infrastructure that you've built that just is a bunch of AI wizards doing stuff 24 hours a day. All of a sudden it was very, it made you very productive because it was essentially free. Well, now it's going to cost you $50,000 a month or whatever. Like, and it's not unreasonable to think that these guys, once they get their hooks, like all tech companies, into the industry, they're just going to crank up the price. You know, we all remember when Netflix was $7 a month, and they always say they're not going to do it, and they do it. Or maybe all of a sudden you'll get ads in your AI. I mean, who knows? These guys will do anything to make more profit once they get to that point. So that's the piece of it that I think the productivity is a bit of an illusion because you're not paying for it. Other, there's a lot of other people paying for your enhanced productivity from AI because you're not.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. Yes, and I think they have already started that. What was $20 unlimited usage is now there's limits on that $20 a month, and now you have to upgrade to the $200 a month complete package or whatever the heck they called it, just to get more tokens. It's still not unlimited, and I don't think it will be unlimited ever anymore because, as you said, it is expensive. I think it is. Yeah, and it's also you're kind of. You can't even self-host this stuff really efficiently, right? Because the GPU, the processing power that you need to run these models efficiently, and also just keeping up with it, I think is going to be a sort of operational headache too. Like as you said, like ChatGPT 5 just came out, which means it's using a new model. How often are you going to be upgrading models? How often are you going to be running did different models. How often are you going to have to get new hardware? If you're just going to buy the hardware from the cloud, are you really saving any money? If you have to buy physical hardware, then you're losing money anyway because you have to get the new NVIDIA card every few months just to keep up with everything as well. So yeah, so I think there is, I think with most of this stuff, there is the, it seems logical that, oh yeah, you know, this is going to be affordable. It's going to increase my efficiency. But the question is, I mean, ultimately, even for us, it comes back to sort of ROI, right? Like, how much time and effort am I going to put into this, and how much is that productivity actually going to increase? And that's why I say, like, how I use it is like, I know how much time I spend on like Stack Overflow and those other things in the past, or just searching Google for an answer. If I know that it's going to cut that time down, then it works. Then I and but frankly, I don't even pay for any of that stuff because I have such low usage because they've kind of put me in that free tier that I don't actually pay for it, in which case my ROI is kind of infinite kind of in that sense. But then it comes back to like how are you using those tools? Are you really using them in a way that actually works for completing the sort of task that you need to do rather than just throwing it into the ring and just hoping that it works?
And it's also like asking the right question as well, which you needed to do when you first started using Google and Stack Overflow anyway. And sort of like the fear now is like there's a new generation of engineers coming into the workforce that just don't know how to either ask the right question, or they ask the right question, they kind of get the answer, but then they don't understand the implications of what that answer is, and just trusting that what they got is it.
I do wonder if we are going to see a slowdown in computer science, you know, improvements in computer science, right? Like, have we got to the point where hardware software is good enough that people just kind of rely on AI now to just kind of output the software that we need, which means that we don't see the improvements in the languages, in, you know, the sort of code structure and ways that we write code anymore, because what we have is good enough, and we don't have engineers working on this stuff thinking about what's the next improvement that we, because AI is not going to improve itself, right? Like, no. Somebody has to write some new code, some new way of organizing software that we can then train the AI on so that the next models can do things in kind of a more efficient way. If we have less engineers doing that, if we have less people doing that and just like pumping out, you know, the sort of next web app instead using existing technology and existing infrastructure, are we going to see a slowdown in improvements in technology as a whole? And I think that could be the worst thing, you know, in terms of side effects of this AI bubble, that could be like the worst thing that can happen, because now we're seeing the productivity gains that we have seen from technology over the last 100 years almost now in terms of when computers started to appear. If we see a slowdown in that, I think that's going to have a long-term detrimental kind of effect on society as a whole.
Well, yeah, because especially if the entire goal is just to output to get more and more and more, right? And if right. that's the case, not spending time on like the computer, not the computer science fundamentals where advancements could be made on power efficiency and like social effect and sort of things like that. Like, yeah, a lot of the foundational stuff in computer science is pretty good there, because, you know, the rules of nature are in place, physics are in play, the speed of light is in play. Like, you, not much you can do about that for the most part, as far as like silicon chips are concerned. But yeah, are there advancements in language design and compiler design and OS design and stuff like that to actually make use of the hardware that we're given? I think there is some room there. Like, we've all, the hardware folks have always said, software folks have never really taken advantage of the full power of the hardware. Yeah. And that's still the case, you know, and we see that when folks build systems in, you know, inefficient ways and, you know, not really understanding those fundamentals. So yeah, there are improvements to language design that could probably happen, but that's not what is making the money. And that's the driving factor. Like, no one is paying for that. Mm-hmm. What people pay for is this other stuff. And so we'll probably see like some decline in computer science, but not, you know, won't completely go away. I think, like I said, there's pockets of population of people that are just not on board and wanna focus on that sort of stuff, or have just a general interest in it. Then we'll sort of figure that stuff out.
I think it is also gonna be interesting to see from the consumption side of things, right? Like when I grew up, we basically had 4 TV channels and you watched the 4 TV channels, but you also consumed other forms of media. And then as I've grown up, we've got a lot more cable TV channels. We've got streaming now, and you've got this entire back catalog that you can watch at kind of any point that you want to, because it's available kind of for streaming on the internet. As we get into the AI side of things, and now you can literally have an infinite amount of TV music to listen to. Like, I wonder at what point, though, you know, yes, we've got the people who just like endlessly scroll and will just sit there and consume whatever is put in front of them. But at what point do we decide that, yeah, I don't really want to consume that stuff anymore, just because it's mm-hmm. just not something that as a whole we want to do. So I think that's going to be an interesting side. At some point, we're going to reach an inflection point as well, like just from the consumption side, like why are we making this stuff if nobody is actually interested in it? So I wonder if that line exists, I guess, is the question, in terms of like, are there going to be enough people who just be like, it's sort of in, yeah. enough's enough? And I'm not sure the answer is to that. But that to me is, I know as we've had more available to stream and consume and stuff, my streaming and consuming has kind of gone down a little bit. But I wonder if that's going to be the case for kind of everybody else as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and whether it's streaming or whether it's some other sort of digital anything at this point, you know, and this seems like a good segue into like the main topic on like computer science education. Like, both you and I, Mubs, like we went undergrad, right? We learned all the fundamentals. We did that path, and we came out, and we started our career doing what we're doing. And then I like I don't know if I could speak for you, but at some point I got to the point of my career, I'm like, I'm really not using a lot of what I learned. Like, I don't care about shortest path algorithms, or like, I can't tell you the last time I did a big O notation of this system. But then, like, and that was like the medium part of my career. But now, as I've grown and got into more complex systems, now it matters. So there was like this weird bell curve where I didn't use the stuff I learned because I was in school learning it. I went into my career and I spent a lot of time building things that were good enough for the scale that they were at, never used my computer science education. But now I'm like coming back and now reapplying and all that stuff I learned to the point where I'm, now in a master's program trying to finish that up to understand actually even more of that because it's now mattering much more because of the scale that this is happening. I mean, just probably most of the engineers that are working at Anthropic and OpenAI are PhDs. Like, there's no other way that you build this stuff without understanding all of that stuff. So is computer science relevant? Yeah, because then you wouldn't have LLMs.
I think it partly goes down to like you said, it's part of your career, right? Like your and this had been fairly normal, I think, as a career path, even though you went to a university college to kind of learn computer science, you weren't necessarily taught the things that you needed to learn to build software. You were taught the fundamentals of, yeah, I was taught, the basic input output systems. I was taught hardware, how chips were built and things like that. But when you get into the career of like, okay, I actually need to write software now for a living, you still had a lot to learn in terms of actually like how software is built in kind of industry and things like that. So I think for the first few years of my career, at least, I was still learning that stuff, even though I had finished my college degree and sort of, all learning how to do bubble sorts and, all these weird sorting algorithms and denormalization for SQL structures and things like that for databases and things like that. But as I got into my career, one, I wasn't given a lot of responsibility, right? I was a junior, I was just starting out. People just gave you the smallest, easiest things that they thought you could handle. And then obviously once you get past that, once you become more senior, then you are the one who has to take on some of the more heavier lifting and system architecture and understanding the implications of like why we're making the choices that we're making, things like that. And yes, then you start thinking about like, should I use SQL for this? Should I use PostgreSQL? Like, does it matter what the table structure under those databases choices are? And are you understanding when you're storing hundreds of millions of records, like what are the implications of indexes and across the right number of columns and things like that? Like you start thinking about those things more because it's your job, it's your responsibility to kind of think about those things. As a junior engineer, I didn't have to think about those things. I was just told, here's a screen, you need to go make this screen kind of thing. And so I didn't think about those things a lot. And I think there is that period in your career where you think, I just went to college and it was a complete waste of time because all the things that I learned in college, I don't need to do. I don't need those things to learn. I don't need to know those things to do the job that people have asked of me. But then once you get past that and you start actually, really building more complex systems and being responsible those parts of the of those systems as well, then you go back to what you learned at school and you're like, okay, this stuff is actually relevant to how we build these things now.
Yeah,
So yeah.
and even still, like some of those things that you're doing at the job now, you learn on the job. But then you go back. Like I did this when I went back for my master's program. There was classes. There was a distributed systems class, and there was an operating systems class. And one of those projects was building a distributed file store. Like that's S3. That everybody uses that. But it took me in the traditional path of a computer science education to get to that. Not until a master's program. Whereas I've interviewed plenty of folks like that come out of like undergrad or 1 or 2 years out of school, and we need to talk about this stuff because that's part of the job. Like you're writing software in a distributed world now. That's just the way it is. And a lot of that stuff is just like very much over their heads because that computer science, that traditional educational background is just not filling those gaps. So it'd be interesting to see how maybe some colleges will see this early on, and like they will keep like the Harvards, the RPIs, the WPIs, the Georgia Techs, they're all going to keep their traditional computer science kind of almost research-based programs in place because that's all fundamental. But I wonder if we start seeing sort of like there's a computer engineering one, which is more, yes, it's computers, but that's all hardware. But what about if this third leg that we're all now playing and now this is more like software engineering or some other third option for these folks that like want to go to school for 4 years, get an undergraduate degree, but come out not necessarily being like amazingly perfect at bubble sort and memory management, but they understand how to work on a team and they understand like the CAP theorem for distributed systems, and they understand the differences between normalizing databases and NoSQL databases and all of this stuff, where like that's part of the undergraduate program instead of waiting until a graduate program to learn this stuff.
It does depend as well. I think when I went to school, obviously that's a long time ago now, but I think there's just a lot more specialization now as well, right? Like when I went to school, when I graduated, most people had, you were a computer science, you were the computer science guy, you were the engineer, but you were responsible for a lot more in terms of like software. Like right now, at least, I feel like you've got ops people, you've got the engine, you've got the systems engineers, you got the back end engineers, you've got the front end engineers. There's just a lot more specialization, and I think it's getting harder for colleges to teach a general computer science degree, because it's like, well, there's so much that you have to learn now. There's so much surface area that you can't possibly, if you try and touch all of it, you're really not going to learn anything at all because there's such a large surface area. So I think to some degree we have to start specializing earlier, which is unfortunate because until you've touched all those things, you don't really know what you really like to do. It's fortunate for me, being a full stack engineer, it wasn't really a choice that I made to be a full stack engineer, because when I graduated, that's what everybody was. Everybody was a full stack engineer. Everybody did system stuff. Everybody did front end stuff. Everybody did back end stuff. You didn't have a choice. You were a full stack engineer. And obviously, over the last 20 years, that's changed with things like React and Vue and JavaScript, and there's an entire universe of people who will never touch an API service or a computer, a back end service anymore. And so I think that's also kind of starting to play into this, like, because most people, when they come out of a computer science degree now, still don't really know what they want to do in terms of like where do they want to specialize. And I think that goes back almost back to the high school level, though, because I mean, I've got some kids who are going through high school now, and well, I've got one kid's going through high school now, one's in college, but they teach them like the most rudimentary stuff, like how to write a for loop and things like that. Like, and I'm like, yeah, it's helpful, but that should take you an hour anyway. It shouldn't take you like an entire semester to write the very, very basic fundamentals of code. But then you actually need to introduce them to the fact that, hey, there's lots of different things that you, even though you say you want to be in computer science, what exactly does that mean? There's so many different options, and trying to expose them to those things in high school would be useful, because then by the time they get to college and you can actually start to specialize, then I think people can really start to specialize and actually pick a path, as opposed to waiting till you finished your degree and then you're picking a path, and then you're spending the first 2 or 3 years of your career relearning what you need for that particular path instead.
And actually, not as you were sort of talking about this, one thing that came to mind, mathematics, I've had this like generally figured out. Like, you can go to school and you can major in math, like actual just research-based math, like linear algebra, discrete math, all that stuff. But there is specialized programs for applied math. Like, you learn just enough math, but then you go to economics, or you learn just enough math and you go be a statistician, or you learn just like. So there might be a path forward for computer science where there's like applied computer science, where you go in and you learn kind of the surface area of, runtime and memory management. Like, cool. That's like a week in one class. Now you go into more like based learning, like actually have a Git repository and you're working with people, or, writing up an architectural design document to then give a presentation at the end of the semester to your professor. Like, I designed this system and here's all my research and this, that, and the other thing. So I think there's maybe there'll be, you know, universities that'll come out with this. I would suspect that some of those might be more of like at the state level. And the ones that can be a little bit more flexible with it, I'm not sure where we might see those from the traditional, you know, Waterloo and RPI and Caltech kind of like offer these kinds of things, because they might just stick with like, nah, we're the purists. We're going to stay with computer science. But yeah, who knows?
I mean, I think it's interesting from the think about it from the demand side too, though. Like, I think the part of the problem is people don't think about computer science as a real hard, hard tech anymore. Because all they see is, I want to build an app for my iPhone. I want to build the next social network. They don't really, even though that's what most people consider computer science these days, and it's really not, right? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. So I think that's why I think people need to be exposed to it younger in life in terms of what computer science is, so that you're not thinking about like, oh, I want to go to college so that I can build the next Facebook. Because, you know, there's more to Facebook than computer science, right? Like, there's a whole other world of sociology and economics that you have to understand to kind of build those things. But I think that's part of why we are where we are, is that when I got into computer science, because I loved computer science. Like, I got a computer in my house when I was 8 years old, started to hack on code. I loved computer science. I feel like a lot of people in the last 10 years, last 20 years have gotten computer science, not because they love computer science, but because, oh, I can make a lot of money in computer science. Yeah. And that there's nothing wrong with that. Like, I'm glad I can earn a good living doing computer science, but I also feel like people haven't got into it to learn computer science. They've got into it for other reasons. And that's part of why we're in the condition that we're in, is that the people don't want to necessarily improve their skills, because all they want to do is move up the ladder, so to speak, so that they can make more money. And like I said, there's nothing wrong with wanting to make more money, but at some point you also have to like the thing that you're doing, so that we can improve at what we're actually trying to do here as well. So I think it is going to be interesting with AI to see how that changes. Like, is the allure of this going to become less because now AI can just do a lot of this stuff for us, and so we don't need, and I'm doing air quotes in the podcast here, we don't need engineers, but I think we'll still need all the ones that we have. Whether we need you know millions more is going to be the question, and maybe it's a good thing that we don't need millions more, that people can use AI to do the rudimentary things that they need to do. And the people that really got into computer science, people who are going to get into computer science because they love computer science, they can do all the things that we talked about earlier in terms of, like, you know, understanding all of these things as you architect these big solutions. Who are the PhDs who are working with who are working with LLMs and scaling Google to billions and trillions of searches and sort of all those kind of things as well.
Yeah, and you know, people ask me all the time, like, why did you start your master's at, like, 40? Like, is it going to do anything for your career? Absolutely not. Like, I'm not taking this to advance my career, move up the ladder, and make more money. I'm doing this because the jobs that I spend doing, building auth APIs and things like that, I kind of don't scratch that itch anymore. Right. But instead, I can actually go and take a class where I'm given a task to, like, go build a distributed S3. Great, that's a fun little project that I didn't have to like try and think up of and do a side project on. Right. And I'm learning that stuff along the way. So like that's, and I think like there are other populations of people out there that just like you said, Bubs, like love the subject, want to keep doing it, want to keep learning it, and want to keep pushing that sort of craft and understanding forward as much as we can through this, you know, I don't want to call it a revolution, but like whatever we're going through right now in this industry. To see what sort of comes out the other side, because we're not the only ones here. Like, there's a large population of people that just still stay in that lane and just love what they're doing.
Well, yeah, this is what this there's a the director of the Paul G. Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington. Her name is Magdalena Balazinski. Last month, she created a bit of a shit show when she said, quote, "Coding, or the translation of precise design into software instructions, is dead. AI can do that. We have never graduated coders. We have always graduated software engineers. The hard problem is to precisely figure out what we want computers to do in order to accomplish some task. That creative and conceptually challenging work is the true work of a software engineer," end quote. So she's basically saying, like, yeah, writing the code, typing this shit into an editor, like, software engineers just aren't going to do that anymore. They're going to do the higher level thinking, or, and then AI will just churn out the letters that go into the file that you save as dot go.
It's like it's the secret bait and switch that like us people that like to write code got hit with. It's like, oh, you want to be a senior engineer, staff, principal, distinguished engineer. Yeah, once you get to that level, you never write code. You are in
You're
meetings,
sitting.
you're writing markdown documents, you are talking with product people, you're talking with salespeople. All the time. That is your job. And you're basically kind of management, but like not actually. You don't have management word in your title. So it's like the secret title
I think
now.
to your point, there is going to be some kind of bifurcation into, because remember when Mubs might be old enough to remember this, I don't know if you, when management information systems became a thing, like it was computer stuff, but you weren't being studying to be a software engineer, or you were just studying how to use computer systems to, run banks or production lines, or that it was about the system itself, the higher level, like how to use these tools to increase productivity or do new things or whatever. So that I can definitely see something emerging where, I have a degree in applied computer systems or something like that. And then there are people who, it's like somebody said to me once, not long ago, like, well, a car is just a tool. You don't know how to fix it. And I was like, well, there are people in the world who know how to fix cars. It's not like all of a sudden everybody who drives a car doesn't need to know how it works. It's like there's always going to be a human being. Again, even if there's a LLM or an AI that writes a compiler, like, some human being better check that, because if there's mission critical shit that relies on that compiler and it's done, like that's the
I
part
do
that I can
think,
see happening.
I do think fundamentally there's a comparison there, but I think it's something that people don't quite understand significance of. It's like when I drive a car, I know I need to put fuel in, I know I need to check the tires, I know I need to check the radiator, make sure it's not overheating, and add wind hyperfluid. Like there's still maintenance that you need to do to the car, even if you don't know how the engine works, and I have no idea how the engine works. But to use the car in the right way, I still need to know there's still 20 or 30 things I need to do on a regular basis, even though I'm not a car person. I think people are losing that when it comes to like software. Like, yes, I know I can just tell AI to build my software for me, but yeah, there's still things that you need to know to be able to like maintain that software and make it run efficiently and make it do the right things. And I think people are losing those skills more rapidly than we're losing the ability to write software from scratch from people like me and plain and things like that. That I think is going to be, I think, like we said, there's going to be a core constituent of people who are just going to exist because they love the sort of the sort of idea of writing software. But we're going to lose an entire swath of people that don't know how to like run software anymore and to maintain software anymore. I think that's going to be the biggest problem. I think that because people are just like, they're building this car and they're just assuming it's just going to work forever and ever and ever. But no, everything needs to be kind of maintained and run. So that's the worrying bit with AI, I think, is that people are going to lose that.
Right, and I think it's worth pointing out too that like the generation before us, Mubs, like all of the shoulders that we're standing on with our modern languages that we like to use to write software from scratch. I'm sure, like Dennis Ritchie and Kerrigan and everybody that like wrote C for the first time in assembly, and like, oh, you young whippersnappers don't know how good it was. But I think generally we share the same core value, right? We're still doing it because we love and have a passion for it, and so did they. I'm sure they didn't do it to make a bazillion dollars. Like, they loved it because they loved it. But I think the difference between like our generation and the next, with the AIs and the LLMs writing the code that we write by hand, like you said earlier, like they're doing this to make millions. Like, that's their goal. And that's, I think, like calling that out is one of the large distinctions between the generational shifts, at least from what
Right.
what I've experienced.
Right. Well, good discussion as always. So that's it for this month's episode of the Lime Leaf Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. See the show notes for links to stuff we mentioned in the episode. If you'd like to get in touch, we're available on Blue Sky, Mastodon, Oak Collective, and LinkedIn. All of those links are on our website at limeleaf.coop. If you'd like to throw us a few shekels, we're always open to getting money from people. You can do that on Open Collective. Just go to opencollective.com/limeleaf. Limeleaf is a worker-owned cooperative. If you're interested, sorry, in starting your own tech co-op, start.coop is a great place to start. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next month. Thanks, guys.
See you later.
Thanks a lot.